Hello? Oh, that's really on. That's too on. My name is Gregory Long, and I'm the president of the New York Botanical Garden. And I just came tonight to say hello to you and welcome you here to the garden. We've had the nicest time working on this big Darwin project with our friends at Cambridge, many levels, and I thought you should know about that because I know you're all Cambridge people. Our particular friend there is John Parker, who's the head of the Botanic Garden, and he's a great friend of David Cohn, from whom you're about to hear, and a great friend of this institution. We're sort of sister institutions in many ways, and he's been a great supporter of this project right along, and of course the librarians at Cambridge, because so much of the material that's in the exhibition you're going to see in a few minutes upstairs has been here on loan from the university, from the library. The Darwin Project started here, really, because we have quite a good Darwin collection ourselves in our library upstairs, some of which you'll see. And David Cohn, the curator, came here and said, does everybody in this institution understand how important plants were to the thinking of Charles Darwin? And I have to say that not everybody here did understand that. And so we thought, well, if we don't understand it, maybe the world at large doesn't understand it, and this is a story we should tell. So John Parker was one of the kind of early one of the early thinkers, one of the early creators of this exhibition. We have many connections here historically with Cambridge. They go back a long time. Your current chancellor, is she called chancellor? Vice-chancellor, Allison Richards, was formerly at Yale. She's a great friend of this institution. We have many collaborative programs, academic programs, and graduate programs at Yale. And Allison was a great friend of this organization as well. I'll just say that you're sitting here tonight under the library and the herbarium. The herbarium, you came in through the main entrance to the herbarium, contains 7 million dried plant specimens. It's the largest collection of plant specimens in the Western Hemisphere. It was created starting in the late 19th century by the scientists and explorers of this organization, and is one of the great kind of glories of the scientific establishment in New York City and in America. And the library, which you'll be visiting, is now the primary library about plants in the whole world. So we have these very big research collections, which are the foundational collections of our academic programs here. We were founded in the late 19th century, really, on the model of Kew. I'm sure many of you are British, or you're Anglophiles at least. The Royal Botanic Gardens of Kew was the inspiration for this institution. We were founded in the 1890s to be both a public education institution and also an academic research institution studying the plants of the world. So we have that long connection with Kew, and today we have the same relationship we've had for a long time. We do a lot of collaborative projects together, and we still have that shape as an institution, both about public education and about research. So I know you have a rigorous program. You have many tours and many treats before you get a drink. So I'm not going to take any more of your time. I just want to thank you very, very much for coming tonight and say how pleased we are to have you here. Thank you very much.
Good evening. My name is Kathy Lord, and I'm delighted on behalf of Cambridge in America to welcome you all here. And our thanks to Gregory and the staff of the Botanical Gardens. It's been a real pleasure trying to organize this event, so we're very grateful that they allowed us to do this. And before I go on to introduce our speaker, David Cohn, who we owe a great deal of thanks to, I just had a couple of housekeeping rules to go over with you. If you would please turn your cell phones off, we would appreciate that. And also, your name tag is your ticket to the event. The Botanic Gardens are closed to the public as of 6 o'clock. So this is your pass to get around and let the staff know that you're here legitimately. Because of the numbers, and really all the people that have registered aren't even here yet, we know there are people coming later who couldn't get out here quite so early. We've broken you down into groups, and the red group on the back of your sticker, on the back of your tag, you will have a colored sticker. The red group will go first. I don't know if Eliza White is here yet or not. She will be accompanying that group. And you will go with Dr. Cohn. Everybody's going to exit that doorway. The red group will go to the library first, and the other two groups will, blue and yellow, will go in the tram tours with guides of the garden. Or, I mean, you're free to walk around on your own, too, but if you'd like to take the tram tour, there will be a guide, and you'll have a chance to go way over to the rose gardens and all around. It's really quite nice. And then the blue group will come back here second and go up to the library with Dr. Cohn. Following that, the yellow group will come back here and go to the library. Ultimately, we'll all meet in the conservatory where you'll get that long-awaited drink. And you'll see the recreation of Darwin's garden. But I appreciate you listening to those logistics. I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Cohn, and there's a biography for him out in the front hall, and I hope you'll take a copy of it. I'm not going to go into all his credentials because that would take up all the time we have this evening. He is the curator of this exhibition and a fellow of Clare Hall in Cambridge. His fascination with Darwin, he tells me, began when he was quite young as a graduate student and took a course about Darwin. And I think he said he had some tension between being either a scientist or somebody in the humanities. And what he's gone on to be is not only a scientist, a biology scientist with his PhD in botany, but he also is a historian of science. So he seems to have brought those two worlds together in a way that we're going to all benefit from tonight. He is, I want to get this right, the director of the Darwin Digital Library of Evolution. And he's based at the American Museum of Natural History. And he's also an advisor to the University of Cambridge Botanical Gardens. I'm delighted to welcome him here and to thank him for his generosity with us. And I hope you'll join me in welcoming him. Thank you.
Be here, and I'm basically an adopted son of Cambridge. I didn't go to Cambridge as an undergraduate, but I spent almost half a year every year since 1974 in Cambridge University Manuscript Room, Cambridge University Library Manuscript Room, which I believe maybe some of you got into during perhaps your undergraduate years or your graduate years, and also to kind of become an adopted son at New York Botanical Garden. Gregory Long mentioned that I came here and saw that there was a unique possibility. And let me just flesh that out a little bit for you. The unique possibility is that there's a wonderful, as you will see later at some point this evening, a wonderful special collections library gallery in this institution with perfect conditions for security, light, etc., for showing the precious manuscripts that Charles Darwin kept all his life. His scientific record is enormous, and it could be displayed here. The other thing is that it is a library, as he mentioned, a spectacular botanical collection, beautifully illustrated botanical works. And hope was that these two could go together. I'll let you judge, but I think that they do. One feature of Darwin's botany, I might add, is that, or might just feature for you, is that, you know, Darwin was interested in really kind of squiddy little plants. He really isn't a gardener in the sense of growing gorgeous orchids and growing exotic plants. He's interested in primroses, he's interested in grasses, in pitcher plants. And I was wondering, well, would this work? Because there are these very squiddy little, that's a technical term. I learned it from a friend in Cambridge. There are all these sort of minor mode Darwin plants. how will they fit with these beautiful pictures? And it turned out that, yes, he did see all these wonderful, wonderful plant illustrations as well in his own time and does comment on them. The third element that I thought this might make a great exhibition or had potential for an exhibition is the wonderful conservatory here. Because, obviously, what's Darwin's botany without plants? And what you have gathered here uniquely is the paper Darwin, this archival Darwin, and the green Darwin, the actual living plants that occupy a great deal of his botanical research. And you'll see in both phases, I trust, the library show where we try to delineate the theme of botany, the theme of Darwin's long-term engagement with plants throughout his life. And then when you go to the conservatory, what you will see is not actually a replication of Darwin's model. I don't think that would be exactly accurate, and I want to be very careful for my friends Downhouse in Kent. It's not a replica of Downhouse. It's an evocation of Darwin's, the grounds of Darwin's home. And these are grounds which were really a living laboratory. Darwin turned that into a kind of a biological field station for the study of evolution through botany. And that is evoked there in the context of a beautiful English garden. Now, let me return to this core theme that I've got a few minutes to speak to you about, which is you'll see in the library exhibit. And that is the idea that plants were important to Darwin. And I want to say this I want to raise this theme with appropriate caution. It's not that Darwin wasn't interested in other aspects of life than plants. This is not a heavy thesis I want to lay out. But I would say that his interest in plants has been neglected, as it's certainly one of the primary scientific areas that Darwin chose to explore through his theory of evolution. And it has certain claim on our attention in this approaching the year 2009, when we're going to be celebrating the 200th anniversary of his life. Botany is the one aspect of the many aspects of natural history that Darwin studied, which can be continuously followed throughout his life. It is a unifying theme. And we can see him as a young man. In fact, if you can turn to the slides, you can see him as a child. This is the earliest known representation, portrait of Charles Darwin and his sister Catherine. And what is he holding? Well, a plant and a pot. And that pot is, let's say, well, he got that at the local florist. No. That came from his father's very large garden. In fact, Darwin, it's fair to say, was to the greenhouse born. Let's see what this is. Yes, his grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, wrote a book called The Botanic Garden, How Fitting. And it's subtitled The Loves of the Plants. Now, what is the subject of this book? It is Linnaean botany. And one of the great discoveries of the 18th century in botany was that plants have sex. They have male and female sex. One can certainly say that that is an obsession of Darwin. He was sex obsessed. And it wasn't only flowers that interested him, but he is exactly following his grandfather's tradition. His grandfather was also an evolutionist. You can say that Darwin gave a true evolutionary significance of Linnaean botany, its meaning. So it is a family endeavor. And to remind you of Linnaeus, this is a book from the library, from this library, The Marriages of the Plants. Marriages of the Plants. If you see over here, we've got sorry, not the word. Sorry. Up in the corner, the left-hand corner, is the wind blowing. And what is it blowing? It's blowing pollen from this male plant to a female plant. Now, of course, in most flowering plants, males and females are in the same structure. And that will be a very important issue for Darwin. But love unites the plants. Here we have a painting. It actually comes to us from the Royal Horticultural Society. And it's a painting of a variety of apples. Now, this variety of apple, these pippins, are come from the collection of Thomas Andrew Knight, who was one of the very first presidents. In fact, I think he was the first president of the Royal Horticultural Society. Charles Darwin's uncle was one of the founders of the Royal Horticultural Society. And Andrew Knight was particularly concerned with the cultivation of apple varieties. There was a great fear that they were going extinct, that they were ultimately degenerating because of inbreeding. And he made it his passion and mission to cultivate new varieties of apples. And he gave some of these apples, apple varieties, to Charles's father, to Robert Waring Darwin, because he was a near neighbor. So again, Darwin is born into this horticultural and botanical nexus. And it's very likely that Darwin played as a young boy in Shropshire, in Shrewsbury, in his father's garden, under trees from that very variety. Later on, the beagle, Darwin, and after the beagle, he will become obsessed with this question of plants that go extinct because there's not enough variation in them, and how grafting can extend of the life of a species. In fact, harking back to his own childhood experience and exposure to apple culture. Now, let me evoke another piece of the exhibit. We are very concerned, of course, with know about Darwin's voyage of the Beagle, 5 years that he spent traveling around the world. And this is a picture of the world, in fact. It is done by what I come to call an extreme Humboldtian. I probably don't know that there are Humboldtian extremists. But Darwin was inspired by the writings of Alexander von Humboldt, as was his professor, John Stevens Henslow, to actually be interested in travel. And Humboldt went to South America. Darwin and Henslow dreamed about going to the Canary Islands. And Darwin was, in fact, fulfilling this hope when he accepted the commission to go the opportunity to go with the Beagle. Now, Humboldt was also interested in a subject, scientific subject that becomes of crucial importance to Darwin and the development of his theory. Excuse me, my mouth is getting a little dry. And that subject is botanical geography, biogeography. He actually sort of put biogeography on a scientific foundation. These extremists here, what they've done is, that portrait is not an island, it's the world. It is every mountain range, every terrain in the entire world. And you see the radial lines going out, and you'll be able to see this upstairs. Each one of them, it represents a species. Are you hearing? Oh, thank you. Each one represents a species, plant or animal, even the fishes are named. And the idea here is that in one portrait, in Imelda, one portrait, you could capture all of nature. This was an inspiration for Darwin. But also would argue that Darwin went in a different way than that. Rather than trying to capture in one portrait everything, he gave us an analytical, well-thought-out scientific explanation of the basis of the unification of all of life. And so there is a dialogue between Darwin and Humboldt that We're trying to evoke for you. When he went to South America, went to Brazil, he was incredibly impressed by the luxuriance of the forests. Darwin, as a botanist, in a way, begins with this falling in love with just landscape, with nature. You'll see examples of this upstairs where language that he developed in just writing about the landscape of Tierra del Fuego, about life and death, he also saw it in Brazil, life and death in balance in Brazilian forests and in Fuegian forests, is extremely evocative of language that he will use later at the end of The Origin of Species. So a kind of mulch is developing here. And you may be familiar with this notebook page. This is a notebook from Cambridge, Darwin's Bee Notebook, the first one in which he sets out explicitly, it's what's called Species Notebook. He sets out explicitly, after returning from the Beagle Voyage, to develop a theory of evolution, or transmutation, as it was called, and really to test the hypothesis, to find evidence for or against the idea that species evolve. That's the way he had always framed it. And this is in the very beginning of that Bee Notebook, and notice he has a tree. The tree is his image. It ever after is his image for the growth of life, for the evolution of life. I like the way of reading this, like iconographic, is I think, therefore tree. And indeed, what do we have? At the base of the one is the ancestral group. All over the place, notice it's an irregularly branched tree. It started in two, it's right away. That's how we continue to see evolutionary trees. Not linear, or not sort of poplar trees, but regularly branched bushes with lines that have ends on them that are kind of buds continuing to grow, and lines that don't have anything on them to be representing extinct branches. So very quickly, he gathers this as a way of representing evolution. And I will skip the fact that Darwin, after opening this notebook, maybe within 16 months, I'm not skipping the fact, after 16 months or so, discovers or formulates the theory for which he is most famous, and that's obviously the idea of natural selection as an explanation both for the origin of adaptations and for the origin of new species. And immediately after that, very, very soon subsequent to that, in 1839, 1840, 41, and 42, Darwin will go back to his father's garden and to his uncle's garden. His uncle is now his father-in-law because he marries his cousin Emma Wedgwood. And they both have wonderful gardens not far from each other. And Darwin will sit in the garden and teach himself the anatomy of flowers, the anatomy of pollination. Here is an example. Darwin's working on a plant called Fraxinella, and you see the different types of anthers and how some bend, some don't. And you can see he's also a wonderful drawer and had a great career as an artist, and that's why we know him. Darwin was a great artist. No. He actually pretty crude draftsman, but a very good anatomist. And the question I'd like to focus you on this evening, because it's one of the major questions about Darwin's botany, is why did he study these plants? This is long before he ever would publish on plants. Why does he study the structure and the anatomy of flowers? And this immediately after discovering natural selection. The answer is that one of the keys to Darwin's intellectual mind, development of his mind, is that he responded to difficulties. If he saw a challenge to his theory, to the generality of his theory. It was a difficulty that he would try to solve. And he encounters an enormous difficulty with flowers. And that is the recognition that indeed many of them, many flowers, have both male and female in the same plant. That is, they are capable, in principle, of easily self-fertilizing. And Dart asks the question, if flowers self-fertilize in perpetuity, what would be the result? Well, they would obviously lose variability over time, and essentially you'd have a series of clones. Now then the question is raised, how did there get to be, in Darwin's time, 50 to 100,000 species of flowering plants? Today we know maybe 250,000 species. But where did all those species come from if they're all produced by clones? And there's only one answer to that, and that would be creation. So there's a metaphysical challenge at the heart of Darwin's body. He has to overcome this threat of obligatory self-fertilization. And what does he do? Study the anatomy, become consumed with mechanisms of pollination that take pollen from one flower to the female part of another flower to maintain variability in the population. And that's a trend that Darwin will be working on for years. Now, at the same time, this is, say, 1840-41, that drawing was made. At the same time, he's developing his core theory. And we know that that's a process that goes through several steps and that ultimately culminates in 1859 with the publication of The Origin. It was a largely secret process, project. Some in his family knew about it. Only one scientist is told about natural selection, the botanist, Joseph Dalton Hooker. And upstairs, I'll tell you why he told them. But simultaneous with that, there are all these other things that Darwin is interested in, barnacles, geology. And one of the things is teaching himself botany. He learns a tremendous amount of botany. By the way, you may know that Darwin worked on barnacles for 6 years. It got to be so bad that the children would go to their friend's house and father wasn't sent over a microscope hour upon end and said, well, where did your father do his barnacles? That was the natural way. I'm here to tell you that barnacles actually are honorary plants because they also have this possibility of self-fertilization. And it's one of the reasons that Darwin picked on the route of checking out the barnacles. Another reason is exactly his fear that there was very little variability in nature. And he was able to show through the barnacles that there was a great deal of variability in nature. This is a good example of how his work in different areas dovetails. That's exactly the same issue as with the botany. Darwin got very good with his plants, and here's maybe you'll recognize this orchid called Comet Orchid, sometimes called Star of Bethlehem, famous plant. I would call it a celebrity orchid. And if you ever call it a Darwin orchid, I'll be very curious with you because there's so many orchids that could be called the Darwin orchid. Anyway, this is one which has a very long, it didn't make that thing work. It has this very long tail here, which is its nectary. And having seen it in England, he predicted that it would be pollinated by a pollinator that would go down there and get the nectar. And the way he conceived of this was that it would be a moth. And a moth with a very long proboscis. That's a 12-inch nectary, so he predicted it would be an 11-inch proboscis moth. And several decades later, a couple of decades later, this moth was discovered in Madagascar, and they added the epithet Predicta to its name, because it was predictive. It's one of those cases. Durham loved to play the parlor game of predicting from the structural anatomy of flowers what the pollinator would be. And of course, pollination is an extremely wonderful case of co-evolution of plants and animals. Familiar with this flower? You see it in florists. Strelitzia, fancy flower. This is a beautiful illustration by Roderick Hay. Here is Darwin's dissection of it. The drawing is not by Darwin. It's not that good. It's by his son, George. But the notes are by, I'm sorry, they're kind of mushy. But the point is, if you compare that with this, you can see that in these drawings on the bottom, it's really not the same concern that Darwin has. Yes, we see the structure of the flower from Roderick Hay. But what Darwin's interested in is, how does this thing get pollinated? And he works out that it can only be pollinated by a bird with a crooked beak, the hooked beak. And again, it's that bird is discovered, that birds in the hornbill creepers in Africa. So he turns botany, evolutionary botany, into a predictive science. In fact, the claim that I'm building towards is that Darwin turns botany into an evolutionary science. And he does it in such a systematic and thorough way, with six books. 40% of Darwin's book production is botanical. He does it in such a thoroughgoing way that evolutionary botany is, in fact, the first evolutionary discipline fully developed. My colleagues and historians of science don't like one to talk about evolutionary biology until the 20th century. Certain things have got to get worked out. But the botany is not true, because Darwin so devoted himself to this and developed a cadre of people in France, Germany, England, and America in particular, who supported his work and his acolytes, and worked more and more, produced thicker and thicker books on evolutionary biology, actually evolutionary botany, that he really is in two generations as a botanist. He's in his own generation, the creator generation. He's also in the next generation. How am I doing? A little bit. Yeah, okay. An insectivorous plant. A microscope. Upstairs, he doesn't understand. And this too. Downhouse, this is Darwin's thinking path. And I would like to invite you all to come to Downhouse after seeing the beautiful evocation of Downhouse here. If you do get to England, it's an easy ride from Victoria Station. You can be there, you can be to Bromley in 19 minutes or something. It's like coming from Grand Central to the Botanic Garden. But then there's an hour-long bus ride or cab ride. Nevertheless, it's a beautiful place, run by English Heritage, and a candidate now for becoming a World Heritage Site. Because in this area, he does such a tremendous amount of research. Experiments that go into the origin, experiments that form the basis of many, many of his books. In the fields around Down, in the ponds around Down, there's this whole area that is alive, and thanks to being in the Greenbelt, is still preserved. So I give you Darwin as a botanist. Thank you. If you have questions, can we reserve them for upstairs when we in the conservatory? I'd be really glad to talk and speak to them about this. Thank you.
Wonderful. And I'd love to know a lot more. I mean, it's been a long time since I studied Darwin, but This, as you may have...
How can you work with Cambridge American?
But now you start reading these things.
Do you read the Vortex issues every morning, one week?
No. The Beagle letters and the Correspondence Project, but...
No correspondence without the origin. No origin without the correspondence.
That's true. David is, will take the first group, the red group, and Eliza White is right over there. You're a red leader. And you'll go with David up to the library and have a chance to look at these things up closely and ask him a lot of questions. The yellow group is, blue is second, I'm sorry, Brandon Doyle will be leading the blue group. You all exit through that doorway and the tram will take you around the garden. And the yellow group is with Kendra Foley, right over here. You're also free to walk around the garden on your own. And we may see you in the conservatory when for a drink later on. A couple of things I forgot to mention that you will notice as you go around the garden. First of all, Henry Moore exhibition. There were statues and a Cambridge Duncan Robinson, president of Master of Magdalen College, was buried as the director of that project and instrumental in it. Also. There's going to be a lot about Darwin coming up in the future. The Letters of the Beagle will be published by Cambridge University Press this fall, and Allison Pern from the university and the Correspondence Project, they're doing remarkable work, will be here, and also Janet Brown, the historian and professor at Harvard, will come, and we're not sure on the date yet because they don't quite know when the book is going to be published, but we'll be letting you know about that. And also, you may have seen this card with a recipe on the back for, they call it creme brulee or burnt cream, which is allegedly a Cambridge dessert when somebody burnt the cream one night in one of the colleges and turned it into a wonderful dessert. There's going to be a cookbook, Mrs. Darwin's cookbook, and that's being published in December.
Are you filming?
That's not awkward.